think our leadership.
This is the second discussion we've been privileged to have with Dr. Joseph Sugar. He's at the ripe old age of 40, had an utterly stunning career in his chosen field. He is a professor in the Department of Family Practice at the University of California, Davis. He's also in charge of their pre-doctoral program. He's had a number of awards in connection with his teaching. Outstanding clinical instructor twice, best role model award, Kaiser Award, and so on. But the most stunning aspect of all is that he was chosen by the American Academy of Family Physicians as Family Physician of the Year, and earlier by the California Academy as California Family Physician. He's held a number of leadership positions, president of the Society of Teachers of Family Medicine. He's had a Kellogg National Fellowship from 88 to 91. He was a graduate summa cum laude from Dayton University and got his MD from the University of California at Los Angeles School of Medicine with a residency at the University of Washington. He's had a private practice in Dixon, California. His topic today is of greater interest to some of us around this table, including the presiding officer, than it is to him, but nonetheless he's probed it to the depth, and we're very pleased that we'll have a chance to talk with him this morning about quality health care for the elderly and the Medicare budget. Are they compatible? So we welcome you once again to our table.
Well, Kenneth, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm a little bit intimidated talking to such an esteemed group of senior citizens about the topic of health care for the elderly. Let me just make not
you,
all
you
of
may you. Have a little competition, but we're used to it, unfortunately, yeah. For a good cause.
Your introduction was very complimentary. To make sure that all of you understand who I am at the core, I'm a practicing doctor, a family physician. I've been in the same community now for 12 years, and I have a large practice of elderly patients, and so I'm their physician. I've spent a lot of time over the last 12 years caring for the community that I practice in, but we have a very hearty, fun to care for elderly community where I practice. I've helped a lot of people leave this world, helped a lot of people cope with the final phases of their life, and I have a great concern about my field in medicine and what has happened over the last 20 years in the care of the elderly, and have taken an interest in this topic. The perspective that I'd like to give, kind of to modify the topic a little bit, is Medicare budget cuts are coming. And I'd like to begin by saying they have to occur. We need to cut the Medicare budget, or we cannot allow the Medicare budget to continue as it has been since 1965 when Medicare enacted. And I'm going to suggest that is compatible with quality, modern medical care for the elderly. And while that may seem paradoxical or incompatible, I'm going to suggest that they are compatible. So I may be taking a rather controversial stand. First, let's talk about healthcare spending and budgets. In 1990, we will spend in this country $660 billion in healthcare. $660 billion. In 1970, we spent $75 billion. So in 20 years, we've gone from $75 billion to $660 billion. We've had a modest improvement in some of our health indicators. Lifespan has risen for men about 5 years, for women about 8 years during that period of time. We've had some deterioration of some of our health statistics. We were 12th in the world in infant mortality. We're now 20th. When it looks at lifespan, actually, we're, I believe it's 15th in the world for men and 7th or 8th in the world for women by country in terms of our lifespan. But the spending in healthcare from $75 billion just 25 years ago to $660 billion has been three times the rate of inflation. The Medicare budget within that has been going up at three times the rate of inflation. And we all know about the federal deficit. We all know about shortages in funding in a number of areas. And we begin to wonder what is happening. There's no question that Washington, the health insurance industry, know that the behavior of the last 20 years can't be continued. But at the same time, the fastest growing segment of our population are the elderly. The elderly are growing in numbers at about twice the rate as other age groups in our population. And the fastest growing people in our society are the people over age 85. And over age 65, people over age 65 have health care costs six times the population under age 65. So current health care costs and behavior over 65 are of great interest and great concern. Okay? So that just kind of lays some of the framework. I'd like to put a little more flavor on what our healthcare budget is doing to our country. In 1970, the healthcare budget was 6% of the gross national product. All of education, from kindergarten through university education, was 6% of our gross national product. And defense, because people often say, well, if we just cut away the stealth bombers, we could do everything. Defense in 1970 was 6% of our gross national product. They were all roughly the same. In 1990, all of education remains at 6% of our gross national product. Defense remains at 6% of our gross national product, about $300 billion. And healthcare has now exceeded 12% of our gross national product. So it has doubled. The amount of our funds per dollar have doubled in healthcare. And incredible, we are now spending more on healthcare in 1990 than we will on all of education and all of defense combined. That what it used to be we were in pair are now doubled. It is projected that unless we change, that by the year 2000, the healthcare budget will be $1.5 trillion from the $660 billion now, without fundamental changes in our healthcare system. I would suggest that we're not going to be able to afford that. I don't believe that we'll have a $1.5 trillion healthcare budget in the year 2000, but that is the projection. Let's compare the U.S. with other countries. This year, we will spend $2,600 per person in the U.S. on healthcare, $2,600. The country closest to us in cost, Canada, will spend about $1,500. So we're going to spend $1,100 per person in America on health care more than the next most expensive country. England spends under $1,000 per year in health care. England and Canada, as you know, provide health care for all of its citizens. It has universal health care. And one of the real tragedies, I'd suggest an embarrassment for the United States, is despite the fact that we're spending at over $1,000 per person in our country more in health care than anyone else, we have 15% of our population who are not getting access to health care, who have no entry into the system other than to land in an emergency room, get shuffled hospital to hospital. It's about 37 million Americans not getting health care. So we have this horrible paradox of the most expensive, we're investing more in health care than anyone else, and we're not providing it. The insurance industry used to benefit from expensive health care. They no longer do. The insurance industry is now in rather desperate straits. You may have heard that Blue Cross and Blue Shield of West Virginia, your neighboring state, is now liquidated. It had to declare bankruptcy. The company has been liquidated. It's been picked up by Blue Cross of Ohio. But many hospitals and many beneficiaries have gone with unpaid bills. And actually, in the last 3 to 5 years, most of the private insurance industry has been scrambling to keep its head above water. Because when you think about it, if we're spending $2,600 for every person, if you look at a family of four, that's over $10,000 a year. Can you insure someone for $10,000 a year of health spending? What would be the monthly premium of an insurance policy at that amount? Well, the monthly premium for a family of four for health care would approach $1,000 a month just to pay for those kinds of averages. And what the insurance industry is doing now in its own desperate way to stay in business is it's having to skim the population. It's having to find people who are healthy, who are less likely to use health care, and insure them. We've now gotten in a situation where in many states people are unable to change jobs, because if they change jobs they have to change health insurance. And health insurance with group rates used to absorb the group of people that were employed. Now health insurance is saying we will not approve prior existing conditions in any employee or any of the dependents of employees. So if your child had a heart defect or your spouse had rheumatoid arthritis or any other chronic condition, if you change jobs and develop new insurance, those would not be covered, and you'd be left without coverage for expensive conditions. This is now sweeping the country as one of the dilemmas. So something has to be done. Expensive health care is robbing from the rest of our society. It is robbing our public education system, where there's little funds. A number of leading politicians have all of a sudden become incredibly interested in this dilemma of health care. Richard Lamb, who was governor of Colorado for 3 terms, has now retired from being governor, has devoted the rest of his career to helping us deal with this health care dilemma. Because he observed, as he tried to run a state like Colorado, that any time there was any potential extra money, it was eaten by the healthcare budget. That the 3.5 times rate of inflation escalation of healthcare would consume it. Well, enough said about the song and dance of the extra costs. What are we getting for our money? Well, the fact of the matter is, and especially when you look at the elderly, we're not getting that much for all of our money. Most of the gains in this century in terms of mortality were made prior, healthcare gains, the dramatic healthcare gains were made prior to 1970. If someone stood in 1900 and set some healthcare goals for the 20th century, and actually Lester Breslow, Dean Emeritus of Public Health at UCLA, kind of projected back in that place. In the year 1900, only 1 out of 20 people lived to the age of 65. The number one cause of death was tuberculosis. the healthcare goals that were projected for the 20th century, such as allowing most people in a population to live to the age of 65 and beyond, to conquer the epidemics of infectious disease and to effectively deal with tuberculosis. All of those tremendous goals were accomplished very well in what was a relatively lower healthcare budget. What we have gained in terms of any mortality and morbidity statistics have been very modest in the last 20 years. So this enormous escalation of costs in the last 20 years has had very, very modest gains, and as I have said before, have been robbing from the rest of society. There's one incredible statistic that applies to the elderly, is that nearly half of all Medicare dollars are spent in the last year of a person's life. And we're spending $50 billion in the last 6 months of life in America. Okay? What has happened, and we've been described as a society that has forgot how to die. We've been described as a society that people who have studied, as say Joseph Campbell, for example, have looked at cultural mankind as long as recorded culture has been available, is we are an unprecedented death avoidance society. That there is a sense of what has been part of human culture prior to modern times was that death was very much a part of life. It was very ingrained in the Native American culture, for example. What has been true in a lot of human culture is that life and death were an intermixed phenomenon. We now do, and what has part of the mythology of modern medicine and modern technology is we can keep anyone or everyone alive for almost an indefinite period of time. When is the margin? If you listen to some of the leading advocates for aging biomedical research in Washington, they'll talk about this ideal that we should work toward in which everyone can live as long as they could possibly live in as healthy a possible state as possible, and then hopefully simultaneously the body would just quietly pass away, maybe at the age of 120 or 125. This is sort of the what I would call the tunnel vision of many advocates in terms of aging research. I'd like to tell you the story of my grandmother, because my grandmother, who I love dearly, is a prototypical example. My grandmother's name is Leona Stahlkamp. She lives in my hometown of Delphus, Ohio. My grandmother's now 97. My grandmother, up until age 90, was an incredibly healthy woman. Her husband actually passed away in the early 60s, so she was widowed quite a long time. When she became a widow, she went to work as a clerk in a local linen and clothing store and had a wonderful, almost 20-year career, about 17 years working as a clerk. She stopped working close to the age of 80 to relax a little bit more, and her vision, because of glaucoma, was beginning to fail some. So she stopped working, remained living independently in her house. Her three daughters, one of whom is my mother, all lived in the area and helped with her. She moved from the big, large house where she raised the family to a smaller home in her early 80s. At age 90, she had one health problem, which was glaucoma, and the only medication she took was drops for her eyes. We had a big party for her at the age of 90. It was an interesting thing is at my grandmother's birthday party at 90, and we took a glorious picture of her, is that she kind of informed everyone in the family that she'd had a wonderful life, that her body was like a Model T Ford whose parts seemed to be wearing out. She was quite aware of her sense organ damage, basically let us all know that it's been great, but it wouldn't bother her at all if she didn't hang around a whole lot longer. And there might have been some prophecy in her comment, because actually about 7 months later, she fell and broke her hip. She had gotten dizzy at that time. She was admitted to the hospital, had a successful pinning of her hip. It was found that her blood pressure was elevated at that time, and was started on some blood pressure medication, and had her hip pinned. She spent 2 weeks in the nursing home with physical therapy, after a week in the hospital. Went back to her house. We hired in someone to help her get things around in the house. And that went along just fine for about a year. When going out into the backyard, she slipped and fell again and broke her shoulder, and was readmitted to the hospital actually for its care. And it was felt in her examination the second time that there may have been a light stroke involved with her fall. She also was found to have some heart problems and was now on 4 or 5 different medications. It was felt that the attempt for her to go back home was not successful, and so she was placed in a skilled nursing home with regular care of the three daughters. She refused to live in the house of any of her daughters. This all happened then at about age 91 and a half. She's a very devout Catholic, Catholic family, and she was a devout Catholic. She began to pray at that time that her life would not go on too much longer. These two mishaps had affected her such that quality of life in her mind was deteriorated. She was very lucid, very oriented. We thought she might be depressed, and actually was placed on an antidepressant after some time, because on a daily basis she was praying for her own death. She's still alive in a nursing home now. She is in a completely vegetative state. She has lost most of her coherent communication. She's incontinent of bowel and bladder. She is unable to do anything but lie in bed. And when she does speak out with things, it's her comment is things such as, "Why am I still here?" And the question is, why is she still here? We have a phenomenon of a new concept. It's not called longevity, it's called prolongevity. Now, there's been no CPR done to my grandmother. You know, we can talk about, do we do cardiopulmonary resuscitation? She's never been placed on a respirator. However, she's been on a number of what are now considered basic and routine medications. We have enormous power in medicine now to prolong life with some very basic things. The quality of our diuretics for congestive heart failure, the natural history of congestive heart failure, used to be about 3 to 5 years, is now 15 years or longer. Sometimes that's nice, maybe sometimes it's not so nice. We have antiarrhythmic drugs because she had some heart rhythm problems, and medical science is doing a tremendous amount to prevent sudden death with, again, basic medications. It has taken a large number of years. The family actually has requested, because I don't live in the area, I've not been her primary care physician. Her primary care physicians have maintained her on routine medicines. They eventually made a decision not to start new medications. When requested by the family to withdraw medications, the response was, "I can't do that. What do you want me to do? Kill her." And the physicians refused to begin to withdraw medications. There was another aspect to my grandmother's care which is still quite rampant in the society, and that is the whole notion of theological determinism, that when people die is really determined by God, and that what doctors do really doesn't interfere with that. That is, God will decide when a person dies. And it's incredible the number of people in the society who firmly believe that. There's another version of that, is the doctor's an agent of God, and God has really put the doctor there to assist in my care. And when my time is here, that's determined by forces that are beyond this world. Just another aspect that makes my grandmother typical, at age 90, her assets were about $100,000. They were placed in various accounts. 4 years later, all of that money was depleted, and she's been dependent upon Medicaid exclusively for her care for the last 3.5 years, at really an enormous expense. If you look at the combined Medicare-Medicaid expenses, Medicaid alone, that Medicaid is health care for the poor, 20%, 1 out of 5 Medicaid dollars is being used on people who are in skilled nursing facilities, in that state of what you could call, I would call, medical captivity, or a state of prolongevity. This is where a massive amount of the health care costs are involved. We as a society are rationing our health care. We have 37 million people not getting health care. We have some key decisions to make. And they're going to be fundamental decisions, not only with medicine, but they're going to be, or within the medical profession, but fundamental decisions that need to be made socially. We can avoid those decisions and end up with bureaucratic fixes and adjustments and things in which could be done in callous and bureaucratic ways, and rightfully so. All of you who are in your seniors should be part of a lobby to keep your health care rights, because you have health care rights the same as any other citizen. What we need to do as a society is define basic appropriate health care. What is the health care that gives us a positive quality of life? And what is bad medicine? Because bad medicine, or health care that just is focused toward quantity of life, is also incompatible in terms of our costs. And these are some fundamental shifts. As a primary care physician, I was fortunate early in my training, while I was in medical school, I read Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book on death and dying. And actually, back in the early 1970s, became part of a study group dealing with death and death acceptance. Doctors who've trained, by and large, over the last 30 to 50 years, and actually doctors in history, have always been able to consider death the enemy. The purpose of being a doctor was to sustain life. There's no question that that is an enormously ingrained part of what makes a doctor. And prior to the medicines of the last 20, 30 years, it was fine for doctors to be that way because they really couldn't prolong life at all. So they could, you know, death was, in a sense, the enemy. And society was filled with tragic premature death at the time, too. So it's an ingrained part of the medical profession. I would suggest that simply holding on to that premise that the goal of medicine is to sustain life and that is the primary goal of doctoring is really untenable in a modern age. We have to shift into some new arena of death acceptance and death planning for people who are clearly in the final phase of their life, and that's not just the elderly. That may be a newborn with problems that are incompatible with life. You know, that may be, and is quite often, the young male with AIDS. We now have, you know, people, we have it in all age groups. Clearly, when you are in your senior years of your life, the other aspect that biologically is becoming more apparent is that there is a natural lifespan. For my grandmother, her natural lifespan was probably in her early 90s. For some people, their natural lifespan is sometime in their 80s, and some it may be in their 70s. If you happen to smoke cigarettes, you've kind of determined that your natural lifespan will be 15 years less than it would have been if you didn't smoke cigarettes. But we have a biological lifespan. The study of the cell will show that there's a programmed life, and there's a hereditary component to that. The biggest factor that determines your natural lifespan is the natural lifespan of your parents. The art of medicine and the art of healthcare for the society is to be aware and attuned to your natural lifespan, and to, in a sense, accept and live your life with that understanding. Many are doing that. I'm impressed at how many people who have the economic resources for everything are choosing to die at home. You know, Mary Martin just died at home. Lauren Green died at home. Hubert Humphrey died at home. With no tubes, no extraneous things attached. And we need to permeate through our society somehow that understanding. I hope that it's not by a lot of bureaucratic policies. My belief is that if everyone has a primary physician, a physician who cares about the big picture with them. One of the problems is when you go into a hospital and you have five different doctors taking care of you, one taking care of one organ and one taking care of another, none of those physicians are willing often to take the full responsibility in terms of a decision of what's appropriate and not appropriate. And sure, we have an ethics committee that sometimes deal with the real dramatic, but often it's the subtle. It's whether or not digoxin should be used, whether or not even taking one aspirin a day is the appropriate thing to do. Should I take the medicine that prevents heart rhythm? You know, if we did a survey in this room, I do this to medical students, so I'm not just picking on you, but if I did a survey and asked you to write on a piece of paper how you'd like to die, not when, but how would you like to die when your time has come? And the most common answer to that is, I'd like to die in my sleep. I'd like to die painlessly and quietly and die in your sleep. Well, many of you are probably on medications that will prevent you, not exclusively, but are likely to prevent you from having that form of death. And it's because they're routinely given to people who develop the various problems of aging. Those are kind of specific practical examples. I believe that we can have a mind shift in medical practice. I believe we can shift especially our primary care physicians, the family doctors, the general internists, the geriatricians, to have an approach that is looking toward appropriate life, appropriate health care, and quality of life as the factor, avoiding a lot of the expensive technologies. I believe that if we can do that both socially and in the medical profession, we can help deal with some of our healthcare cost issues and not have quite as many very controversial and maybe cold and callous bureaucratic solutions. Thank you.
Who'd like to begin the question? Henry Fieldberg?
How do you avoid this rulemaking, the bureaucratic situation? We went through it in our family with my sister. And it was a long, drawn-out problem, and it was just a real mess. On the other hand, I have some concern about who is making the decision. I would have no concern at all. In fact, I would be very pleased to have a decision made by, let's say, Matt, in whom I would have full confidence. But if I were in some strange hospital, as it were, and the decision was being made by a committee of people that I had no empathy with, I would be quite concerned about that. And it seems to me that it's well enough to talk about having the decision made by the caring physician who knows your background and knows your point of view, as against the factory-type operation that a very large part of the population would be in. How do you control that kind of a difference?
I agree completely with your concerns. The people who should make the decision, I believe that we can afford all of the health care that people really want if they make informed decisions. And I think that... because I don't believe that we need to be caught in a situation where people are asking for everything. I do not get many 80 or 90 year old people with end stage heart disease asking for a heart transplant. even though we now have enough transplant centers who are willing to do it. How many people in this room have a living will, have a medical document? Very good. You're way ahead of the national average. So I'm speaking to an informed group. This should be a personal decision that you make with your physician. But because we're a mobile society and we have ambulances and we have 911s, you need to have that written down. You need to have that somewhere there that will say, you know, either do not resuscitate, I do not want to be placed on a respirator in an intensive care unit. You now need to go more specific. Our document in California, a living will that's now been combined with a legal document called a durable power of attorney, has several categories that you check that describes the care that you would like, and then you also designate a person you trust to be your agent. You give that person full control to even change your decisions. You know, you give that person an ability to say, well, you might say, in general, I don't want to be placed on a respirator, but you might have a condition like an auto accident in which 6 hours on a respirator to fix you, you know, to fix your leg is all you need, and that person can say, yeah, this is an exception. You know, go ahead and give the anesthetic. So you've got an agent for your behalf. But you need to have that kind of direction in writing. We're entering a brave new world, as Richard Lamb calls it. It's a brave new world where probably for the first time in history, we have more health care than we need available to us, or that we may want, and or that may be a marginal benefit, and we got to make some difficult decisions and choices. And this is a new thing. You need to have that down such that you may not get trapped into a situation where you're in an intensive care unit for 30 days on a respirator before you actually die. People like that in their 80s and 90s are in virtually every intensive care unit in every hospital in this country at a cost of $3,000 or $4,000 a day because no direction is there. And it's very hard to withdraw care. It's very hard, as we learned in the Missouri case with a young person, that unless they made it clear that they wouldn't want to live in a vegetative state, the state has a right to persist in that vegetative state, even if the family says no. Well, whoever saw her say anything different?
Next question. Yeah. Mrs. Yilke.
How do Canadians and British manage to keep their health care costs down? Do they not give this extended care to the elderly?
They have the same concerns and problems that we do in dealing with it. They have not invested in a lot of intensive care. The number of intensive care beds per population is very, very low. They have socially, for those who have gone over and studied it and studied their society, they have not caught up in the American attitude of everything can be fixed and everything is provided. A lot of elective surgeries are often, there's a considerable wait. I mean, there's a long wait in Europe, even for something that we would consider an emergency, such as a bypass surgery or an angioplasty, a procedure done to open up blood vessels. Those aren't necessarily immediately available as they're immediately available for anyone here. So they've rationed on the basis of availability of what they've chosen to invest their money in. And that has, there is a subtle but real difference in social attitude and expectations.
Lucian Burnett?
That was my question.
Or same question. Wilson, do you?
Doctor, I came here expecting to hear a dissertation about how to live, and I've just heard a very brilliant exposition on when to die. It must be obvious to you, as it is to me, that I have more than a casual interest in the subject. First, the figures, if I recall them, you indicated that the per capita cost in medical care in Canada and the UK is 40% less than the US. And you also indicated, if I recall correctly, that 50% of the cost is expended upon persons during the last 6 months.
That's of Medicare. That's not total health care costs. That's the elderly's cost.
That's probably a representative sample, though. Is there a significant difference in the care in Canada and England in the last 6 months of life than there is in the U.S. under the Medicare expenditure in the last 6 months of life?
I wish I could give you a real specific answer. The best I can probably say to you is I'm sure they do, because they don't spend that kind of money on health care near the end of life. There are a number of criteria, and again, I have yet to do enough traveling and study to give you lots of specifics. One of the things Richard Lamb, who is one of my mentors, the retired governor of Colorado, is going to spend 6 months next year searching those answers to just those questions and try to get specifics, because quite incredible, we're a rather insulated country here in knowing just how the other countries do it. A lot of public health people have studied the national health programs and how they're structured and some of these other things, but how they actually get translated as clinical policy, as actual application, I've yet to read good descriptions. They clearly, I'll give you just an example. I have a colleague who's an ophthalmologist, excellent ophthalmologist, very compassionate, good man in my community. And one of his patients that he wanted to do cataract surgery on, in the preoperative physical that was done by the internist, the patient was found to have lung cancer. And the lung cancer was fairly advanced. It had spread to several other areas of the body. Now, advanced lung cancer carries a life expectancy of clearly under a year. It's one of the most lethal forms of cancer, and this particular woman's life expectancy was estimated at about 6 months. And she rather forcefully said, "I still want my cataract surgery." And she received her cataract surgery because there's nobody that would say no. I mean, basically, if a doctor says it's time for your cataracts to come out, it's time to come out. There's no check and balance on that. Medicare, basically, all the Medicare has done is decided what they'll pay the ophthalmologist, and they reduced it by 10% last year. But cataracts are an example. We spend in our country an enormous amount of money on cataract surgery. Now, in England, if you wanted cataract surgery, you applied in the system for it. You got in line. You were in a queuing system for that cataract surgery. And if your life expectancy was 6 months, you'd be on a low priority scale, or you would never end up having cataract surgery. One of our scandals in America is cataract surgery is being done way prematurely. We have it way in excess of that. But that was just an example of what we provide in America. Our expense at doing cataract surgery is probably more than 40% higher in England. That is, we pay the doctor, the hospital, the anesthesiologist, and everyone else way more than any other country does. So we're overpriced. Overpricing is as big or bigger a problem in America than even overuse, although they both together contribute to the situation.
Can I ask you a follow-up question?
Sure.
It sounds to me as if you have an evangelical approach for a philosophy that is needed in our time. I'm just wondering if in and I subscribe wholeheartedly to, I think, the thrust of your thinking. But I'm just wondering if it, the initiative shouldn't be on the value of life rather than the cost of life.
I completely agree. You know, even if cost were not the issue, I think we have a serious quality of life situation. I mean, very few people can spend more than a few minutes in a lot of skilled nursing facilities without the impression that something is wrong, it's an unfortunate circumstance. And it's a, you know, costs aside, how we wind down our life. You know, something that's not getting into the press very much, and it's clearly not known, but senile dementia, the evidence suggests that it is a natural part of aging. That if you look at age and you look at Alzheimer's disease or senile dementia, they are directly related. You know, at age 100, over 50% of all human beings have Alzheimer's disease. You know, at 90, it's a percentage of 25 or 30%. It's an inevitable process of brain deterioration, atrophy, diffuse atrophy or shrinking of higher cognitive function. Quality of life issues really should come to the front, and I believe that we should deal with the dilemma on that issue. AARP, one of the strongest lobbies now in Washington, is more and more addressing the issue. I mean, they're talking out of both sides. One is entitlement to everything, and at the same time, let's deal with some quality issues. I would hope that the leadership in this whole area affecting the elderly would come from the elderly, so they're not victims of social policy. Right now, the severe state of child care and child education that we have in our country in terms of public education and the great needs there have made a target that made healthcare dollars even more of a target and healthcare dollars for the elderly more of a target that I think in the next few years some things are going to happen pretty fast. But I would hope that, and I would wish that the seniors and the physicians and other healthcare workers who care for the seniors can be out in front in this issue rather than just being in a reactionary mode.
Dr. Chris Bell?
Well, it's a wonderful review. I must say at age 40, when I was in medicine, I didn't have the guts you have.
You're not the first person that's told me that.
Let me ask you a personal question about your career and then respond to the Bree system. I know many of your teachers at UCLA, longtime friends. Who turned you on? Anybody there? Dave Solomon, Sher Melnikov? Who turned you on? Reason I'm asking is
Dave Solomon and I argue about it because Dave Solomon is on the other side of this issue.
I know. But somebody turned you on.
Right.
The last 10 years since I have put stuff in papers, I've spent a lot of time with undergrad. Thank you.
attitudes changed. One day we were hating them, the next day we were playing ping pong with them.
Right.
And I think the lack of leadership in healthcare in establishing a direction for the country is really where we need to go. People like yourself, other state agencies, state officials, are trying to do it in sort of a piecemeal fashion. But we've had no coherent guidance right. from the country. And I wonder if you could just comment on
sure.
that.
Sure. I completely agree with the leadership and the need for that and the focus. Completely agree with that. Your first comment, and I'd love to see a reference, and I think I need to correct one thing you said. Americans want more health care. They don't want more money spent on health care. And they are unwilling to pay more taxes for health care. Is America willing to put more money, tax dollars, to put more money into Medicare and Medicaid? And the answer is no. But so the real dilemma is that they want more and they want complete access, but they aren't willing to pay for it. And so that gets us in that dilemma. And I agree that public perception is a huge part of the problem. But I wouldn't let our profession off the hook that easy. Because I think to a great extent, the technological advances and everything that's been written and described and offered about them has fueled public perception. I mean, we have four times as many transplant teams as any intelligent person predicted or suggested we need to do the needed heart transplants in America. By any health policy design, how many heart transplant units are needed? But every university, whether it be here or anywhere else, one, it's lucrative, and we don't have any qualms about charging whatever the market will bear. And if you're going to be a prestigious center, you need to be like and do all the various things. And so there's no restraint within our field that's based on social need and social conditions. And I think that the responsibility and the need for leadership is dual. I mean, it's every bit as public in terms of what you said, but I think that a lot of the problem has been generated through our healthcare system and the way we responded, the way we as a profession, both doctors and hospitals, responded to the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid. You know, one of the ultimate ironies is the American Medical Association bitterly opposed the enactment of Medicare in 1963, and were angry about it in 1965. But yet, the guidelines of Medicare trusted physicians and hospitals to provide the care they did, to do their job, and not to. But it left an uncontrolled system of reimbursement, which then was basically was maximized and sent out and. And it, my impression, you see, who's to blame? You know, when an elderly opens the paper and they see a full-page ad by an ophthalmologist saying free cataract evaluation, we'll let you know if you have anything. You know, is the public to blame for going in excessive numbers and asking for cataract surgery when our field is basically marketing? You know, marketing is the biggest name in both hospitals and in private practice of medicine, when we're marketing our services beyond their need. So we're all caught up in it together. And it's going to take some fundamental shifts. I think that so many people are caught up into single issue, single priority. You know, I'm going to vote in this election based on my stand on abortion, or based on your stand on education, based on your stand on the environment. And we're caught up into this tunnel thinking of what's best for America. And what we need, that we need people who can be leaders to in a sense give a vision of balance and a vision of a system. You know, where are we going to go? Some of the best and brightest people in this area, Uwe Reinhardt, the health economist at Princeton, and others, are thinking that the West German model of healthcare is probably the model that America could tolerate or would move toward. And let me just describe that just very briefly, because I don't know a whole lot about it. But tax dollars actually only pay for 20% of health care in West Germany. They have universal health care for their population. But tax dollars pay for 20%. America, we pay for 45% out of tax dollars. Private insurance pays for almost 80% of health care. But it's negotiated, designed private insurance of different types to meet the needs. It has a lot of price controls, negotiated, organized price controls that's both government and private industry regulated. Doctors' incomes are fairly fixed. In 1970, prior to the modern enactment of that, actually West German physicians were the highest paid in the world. They now earn less than American physicians on the average. There's been very little increase in income over the 20 years. There's been a great control on costs, and they basically renegotiate new formulas. But that's being looked at as the kind of leadership and possibly the kind of a direction that we'll go to.
Howard Cromwell.
I wanted to ask, in your studies, to what extent is the threat of liability suits a factor in cost? And if it is, does the legal profession have a responsibility in not opposing some limit on these liability suits? I'm thinking in terms of obstetrics.
Sure.
Now it's getting almost impossible for some. Yeah. And some doctors are going out of the business.
That's right. Family physicians in enormous numbers have been driven out of obstetrics just for that reason. It more than doubles my liability insurance. I'm still active in obstetrics. I'm glad you mentioned it, because it's a big, big part of the problem. It's been estimated that at least one-tenth of the increase in healthcare costs, or the total budget of healthcare, is done in defensive medicine or liability-related medicine. You know, it's become the lottery system, and it's become a social disease. I mean, it's a sense of entitlement. If I've been injured, you know, it's no longer God's will or the doctor did the best they can. It's that, you know, I deserve compensation, and there's been created in our society. And again, it's hard to point the finger. What role did doctors have? What role did lawyers have? What role did whoever had in producing this? But that has got to change. So any real reform, any real bringing under control our healthcare costs is going to have a legal, a medical liability solution as part of it. And some band-aid, little bit attempts have been done at that. California is a leading state. We used to be one of the worst five 15 years ago, and our insurance costs were now about 30th because of reform in the system that we've been able to enact. But the trial attorneys are trying to overthrow it every year, and so it's a big problem. One other thing I just want to mention as an enormous part of our problem, $660 billion, 20% of that goes to administration. 20%. We spend more in 1990 doing administrative work in our healthcare system. We spent actually almost twice as much in administration in 1990 as we did doing our whole healthcare system in 1970. That the growth of our administrative costs of our disorganized system are in another enormous piece that needs to be reformed and consolidated.
Canada is 6.2.
What's that?
Canada is 6.2%.
Yeah.
Bill Wemple?
No, my question was, Mr. Cromwell got the jump on me.
Oh, he did, for
once. I thought it wouldn't do to have this session without at least one bad word for the lawyers. And he put it very nicely, and the answer was clear and convincing.
Good. Victor Yonke?
I'd just like to make a couple of observations.
We're a little short on time, so...
In the Sick Children's Hospital in Toronto, it's a very huge hospital, city blocks long, and a very, very fine hospital. There's no waiting list there. and you can come to the United States or Quebec or any place else and go into that hospital. The Shoulders Hospital in Toronto is basically a surgical hospital. Same policy applies there.
That's right.
People go from here to there.
Yeah, we exaggerate the problems of Canada and England as part of our own defensive reaction is done. You know, in Buffalo, New York, 1/4 of all of their CT scans are Canadians who want a CT scan now, and they don't want to have to get approval for it in the Canadian healthcare system. So there's now a border market going on for things, but most of those CT scans, maybe all of them, are unnecessary. Yet, you know, they've got people who are willing to pay cash for them to get what they want. And there will always be that. There's that in England. You know, the tighter the screws in England happen, the more of a private system for people who can afford it, because they want, you know, what they read about in the paper or hear about from America. You know, the illness, the problem we have in America with the proliferation gets national press. You know, it's a world information market now, and so we tend to affect, we're a real problem for other countries. Daniel Callahan, the director of the Hastings Center, who's another one of my real mentors in this area, as in his travels in Europe, where we sort of look at Sweden and England and Germany and these other countries as having it under control, they look at, you know, they say to him, he says, we are watching America, because unless you figure it out how to control costs, none of us are going to be able to, because we don't know what to do with this MRI scanning. You know, what conditions need an MRI scan? We know how expensive they are, and the CT scans and the other things. And so they're really looking at us actually for some leadership, or their systems, even so, will get in trouble. But you're right, most people in Canada, England, other very important information, and a guy by the name of Blendon at Harvard has done this study. If you do satisfaction, if you survey the population, do you get the health care you want? Yes, no, or a scale of 5. Do you have to wait for the health care you feel you need? Are you satisfied with your health care system? Canada, England, and all the other countries score better than we do. So, I mean, by any population surveys, there are not the complaints. You can always cite the examples of someone who had to wait or maybe came to America. But if you survey the people, they're very happy with their healthcare system.
President Chan?
Well, you mentioned California doing something about this on the liability thing. I wonder, this is such a huge problem that involves the elderly, the doctors, and the government, that to take hold of it and make some progress somewhere seems very difficult. Is this something you think, if you are going to cut costs and they're going to try to take hold of it, that point you should do nationally, or is it something that should be done state by state?
It's a good question. You know, in Canada, their health system was developed province by province, and actually each province has a modified different healthcare system. So it was actually done in a decentralized way. The commitment was made federally, but the solution was not a central monolithic solution. And I think there are different solutions, and there's some model for that in America. You know, Medicaid is a state-by-state model. Arizona said no thanks from the very beginning. They have no Medicaid system in there. So yes, I think that the right thing is usually done better when it's done more locally than when it's done centrally, although the leadership to bring it about nationwide is going to require a lot of, you know, it's going to need central leadership and vision, but enactment, local solutions are probably real important. Virginia has done some innovative things in the liability area. I don't know how they've worked out over time, but that's where a lot of the change needs to come from.
Well, our Jeff O'Connell, you know, has introduced no-fault insurance at the federal level. The trial lawyers were so powerful, it never got out of committee. So when you start at the federal level with no-fault, which Jeff has got partly in Virginia, but not totally, I think the federal level is just going to be hell because of power of the trial attorney, of the attorney.
Any other? Well, I guess we've come to the end of our hour. Those of us who have heard Joe Sugar before knew we were in for a medical and philosophical feast, and we've had that, and we're terribly grateful to him and hope he'll come back many times.
Thank you.